Hello, welcome to the Data Science Salon podcast. I'm your host, Q McCallum, AI consultant, writer, and senior content advisor here at Formulated By, which is the company behind this show. Today's episode is a recording from our recent Data Science Salon event, which focused on applying AI and machine learning to finance and technology. I sat down with data scientists Linda Liu from HireCar and Giacomo Vianello from Cape Analytics to talk about their work. We explored the techniques and tools for the various data projects they're running, some of the challenges of working with geospatial data, and how their companies approach data-related research efforts. The hint for that last one, by the way, is that balance, discipline, and structure rule the day. That's a great take-home message there. And with that, on with the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's Coffee Chat. This is a space where I get to sit down with a couple of guests, toss out some questions, and generally riff on ideas about life and work in the world of AI. I'm Q McCallum, Senior Content Advisor here at Formulated By, which is the company behind Data Science Salon. And today I'm joined by two experienced data scientists who are also speaking at the event. Let's start with some introductions. Linda, have at it.
Yeah, thank you. I'm happy to be here. First, I want to thanks for, you know, the invitation, as I have been a big fan of Data Science Salon since 2017. And over the years, I have followed through, and then I'm very much honored to be invited and be more involved in this great community. I lead the data analytics and data science team at HireCar. I have had a lot of experience helping a business build analytics and data science foundations, as well as roadmaps that empower data-driven decisions and improve user experience across the organization. I'm also a big believer in cultivating a data-centric culture that enables teams across a business to better utilize data and analysis and bring added value to the day-to-day work.
That's awesome. Thank you very much, Linda. Welcome in. And Giacomo, welcome to you as well. How are you today?
Thank you. I'm good. How are you?
Just fine, thanks. So please give us a quick bit about yourself.
Yeah, my name is Giacomo. I am a lead data scientist at Cape Analytics. Cape Analytics is a startup in Silicon Valley that works on intelligence on properties for the insurance and the real estate markets. And I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for the invitation to this very nice event. Here at CAPE, we work with artificial intelligence and machine learning to extract information from aerial images and other type of data. And my role at CAPE is to develop models and as well as improving and working on the model development process to make it faster, better, and more efficient. And before working at Cape Analytics, I spent almost 10 years at Stanford University during astrophysics. So I was doing something pretty different, but actually not so much. I always joke that back then my satellites were pointing up and now they're pointing down. But there are actually a lot of similarities, much more than I expect. So anyway, happy to be here and looking forward to this discussion.
All right, that sounds great. Thank you both. Now, to get started, I usually start these coffee chats off with a couple of high-level questions before we get into some of the deeper topics we discussed before we hit record. So just for the basics, something I like to ask of all of our guests is, you know, based on your experience, what do you find different and interesting about working with data at HireCar and Cape Analytics compared to doing this on other fields or companies? So for example, you know, this might be different challenges you face because of the industry you're in, or different rules and regulations to which you're subject, or maybe new things you had to learn moving into this field, and so on. So Linda, let's start with you. What do you find interesting about working with data at HireCar?
Because for me, I always consider, you know, data as my playground, and specifically for HireCar. So let me give a little bit introduction for HireCar. HireCar is a car sharing marketplace that helps local car owners rent their personal vehicles to ride sharing, meal delivery, and business delivery drivers. For example, if you have a car that is not used much, you can list the car on our platform. When that happens, we facilitate a match to a gig driver who needs a car in the area. If we were to oversimplify this a little bit, it is akin to a dating app for vehicle rental in a gig economy. In that case, it is a win-win solution for all parties involved. So with that being said, there are two primary groups of customers, drivers and owners. We want to better engage the customers and streamline the user experience to enhance customer satisfaction and grow the business. So that is definitely challenging, but interesting because we have two different customer groups and then we want to facing different challenges. And then our different strategies from the business side, as well as from what the data can bring, has to target both sides, because only both sides grow, then we can grow.
Exactly. So it sounds as though hired cars in the center of what economists would call a two-sided marketplace, right? And when you're in the center of a group like that, your entire job is to keep both parties happy. That way, if you keep parties A and B happy, that means you're happy and there's a win-win-win all around. And so all of the AI tools you're working with, all of the work you're doing is to facilitate that, correct?
Right, definitely. So for example, we have a different data and analysis and a machine learning projects across the different departments of organization. And for me, the goal of data science is always help better decision making and to add values to customers. In our case, it's both the drivers and owners. And therefore, most of my work has centered around these areas. For example, the customer retention and then churn prediction for both drivers and owners, and then marketing attribution for both owners and drivers, and some a geospatial analysis for both owners and drivers.
Excellent. And speaking of geospatial analysis, I know Giacomo, your company does just a little bit of that, just a tiny bit. Would you kind of tell us a little bit more about what you're doing at Cape Analytics and why it's different from working with data and other fields?
Yeah, so you touched on the geospatial part, and that's definitely part of it. We are in many ways a geospatial company. Everything we do is localized on a map, because as you can imagine, when you want to study the value or the risk or properties, which is what we typically do, you want to make sure that you're talking about the right property, and also within the property of the right thing, like the right building, the right pool, the right whatever you're studying, right? So we actually have a lot of development around getting this localization precise. There is an entire problem that is called the geocoding problem, right? Where you start from an address and you want to see, okay, well, this is an address, where it is, right? Where is it actually on a map so that I can study exactly that and not something else, right? And so as you can imagine, I mean, this is kind of the very first step of our product. And if you get that wrong, whatever model you have, even the most accurate model in the world, is not going to be very useful because you're studying the wrong thing. So that's a very, very key problem. And in general, this geospatial aspect is everywhere in our data. That means that you need specific types of databases, specific types of data, technologies and procedures. And it also adds a lot of fun to, machine learning and analysis, because you always have to consider the differences in characteristics by location. For example, if you say that you are studying a house looks very different if it's in California or Vermont or Australia or Canada, right? And so, for example, one thing that we do is we train models that do segmentation of houses, right? They can find where the house is. You have to show the model all of this data and all the diversity of this data in order for the model to perform well. So it's a very interesting space, and there's a lot of variety, and it's you know, we look at a lot of images and a lot of places, so it's also so fun in that way. Sometimes you find also very crazy things, like I remember we found a property somewhere in Virginia that has a tank in the front yard, and yeah, other things like that. So there's also a fun part. We have even a Slack channel regarding this. It's called Weird Earth. We exchange all the weird things that we find. It's quite fun. Jokes aside, it's a very interesting space, and it's also exploding. The amount of data that we have today that is geolocated is really growing and growing. There are a lot of vendors coming online with new data set and new types of data. So it's really an exploding field.
Yeah, I can imagine. It's funny, while you were describing the company, I was just about to ask what's the weirdest thing you've seen, and then you just mentioned the tank story. So I think I'm done there. Don't have to ask now. Sounds pretty cool, though. All right. And so you two have both touched on this a little bit in your introductions there, but I'd love to dig a little deeper and talk about some of the specific projects you're working on. Now, clearly, we don't want to get too deep into this. I'm not asking you to reveal any sort of secret sauce inside the company, but given the work you two do, you know, what sort of data science or machine learning or AI projects are you running to support the business? And what sort of machine learning techniques or algorithms does that require? So Giacomo, let's start with you on that one.
Yeah, so we do different types of projects, but we can probably group them into two or three groups. Let's say three groups. One is computer vision based, right? So you typically start from images, and you want to extract some intelligence from these images, some, you know, features or characteristics of what you're seeing. And then we have the more classical machine learning kind of project, where you have a tabular data set, you have to do just modeling on tabular data, and that's the more classical machine learning domain machine learning. And then the last one is more the analytics part, where you want to study the behavior of customers or of other people or objects. And so it's more like exploratory and visualization dashboards, these kind of things. For the computer vision, as you can imagine, is deep learning based, and there we do all sorts of deep learning on 2D data, 3D data, classification, segmentation, all sorts of things. That's a very interesting field. It's also a field that is evolving very fast. There's a very quick pace of research. And so one of the challenges and also the fun is to keep in touch with the research and to be aware of what's happening, to be able to exploit the newest techniques and modeling, and also to be able to kind of apply things that come out of the research into more of a production setting. So there's definitely that part. We have a journal club. We have a channel where we collect all the papers and all the things that we read that are interesting, and we try to talk about these things a lot to foster ideas and in general to stay up to date. We also started to talk at conferences like this one, and so on and so forth. So there's that's the very interesting field. Is also pretty R&D heavy. We have several R&D projects in that kind of field. For the classical machine learning, things are a little bit more defined, but there's also a lot of research and a lot of things happening in that space as well. Even though maybe it's lower than in deep learning, but it's still a very dynamic space. And so there, technologies and techniques are more, classical machine learning. So, your scikit-learn, linear regression, boosted decision trees, random forests, these kind of things, support vector machines. And and then the last one is, you know, data exploration. That's you know, the domain for clustering and dashboarding and all of those things. I'm happy to go deeper into any of these things, but this is kind of at the high level.
No, I think that high level is great. I do have a couple of questions for you, a couple of follow-ups. But before we get there, I wanted to double check with Linda's side as well. So Linda, given the work you're doing at HireCar, what sort of machine learning projects are you running to support the business? And what sort of techniques or algorithms does that work require?
Yeah, first I'll say this is a great question because it's something very close to my heart, as I have been a big proponent of AI machine learning techniques. But don't worry, I'm not a zealot. I will not tell you, you know, AI and machine learning is a cure-all and will solve all your problems. Because, you know, in the day-to-day business, some tasks are particularly well-suited to these techniques, but definitely not all. I think what I love about them is the fact that they allow us to tackle difficult problems that might be otherwise too daunting. Over my career, I think natural language processing has definitely served me well. I've had a lot of success with both supervised and unsupervised learning in the natural language processing like area. One particular interesting project dealt with, you know, gaining better understanding of customer friction points and delivering insights to help customer support and product development using the, like, by analyzing the unstructured data from the customer tickets and pieces. So in that case, first, I use the unsupervised learning to extract the hidden topics from a large volume of customer tickets based on the LDA algorithm. After an optimal number of topics was created, we applied supervised learning on a customer sample set to implement multi-class classification using a set of candidate classifiers, such as logistic regression, naive Bayes, support vector machine, random forest, and so on. The best scoring model and is then operationalized for consumption. Another favored area is customer retention and churn, because, you know, it's definitely a big, like a very, like an area with lots of focus for any business. Customer data comes in primarily in three main categories, according to what we collect: profile data, transaction data, and behavioral data. Using all the three categories, we look at whether customer will churn or not after a given period of time and the probability of that churn. Here, we trained our model with a few candidates, such as random forest, K nearest neighbors, logistic regression, stochastic gradient descent. The best scoring model, the best scoring one is picked, and the hyperparameters are tuned before operationalize. There could be also other things. For example, when we are trying to work for the marketing attribution, we are using the Markov chain model that helps us better understand customer acquisition and customer journey efficiency. So we can design an optimal journey to reduce directions and optimize marketing and sales spend. Leveraging the Markov chain method, every customer journey can be expressed as a chain in a directed Markov graph, where each vertex is a possible state and edges represent the probability of the transition between the states. Then by computing the model and estimating transition probabilities, we can attribute every channel or touch points.
That sounds great. And it's interesting. You don't often hear about people running Markov chains these days in the data science space, but they're very popular and useful in other domains I've seen. Also, what I liked about both of your answers is that it seems as though, you know, classical machine learning, it's definitely still going strong. I know a lot of people are very interested in neural networks, and they definitely have proven themselves very useful, especially when Giacomo's talking about doing image analysis and that sort of thing. But classical machine learning sounds like it's going strong and here to stay. So that's great. Something else that I find interesting is, and I know, Linda, you kind of joked at the beginning that you're not a Zilla and you're not going to tell us that machine learning will solve all of our problems, which it's okay. Plenty of salespeople are already doing that for us. But it is good to hear that both of you are really applying all these techniques to solving real business problems in your companies. I think that's super important. Also, one quick one for you, Giacomo, I forgot to ask. You mentioned like an interesting word in the middle, that your company is analyzing the risk into all of these properties. So if you're doing any sort of risk analysis, I take it you're probably doing a decent amount of Bayesian data analysis as well, like they use in the insurance field, or no?
Yeah, we do. We do some of that. The important thing to say, though, is that Cape Analytics, the company, is we are not so much in the business of doing the risk models. We are in the business of providing attributes and things that can be used to do those models. So our customers, for example, an insurance company, will have their own models, mm-hmm. And they have their own kind of secret sauce to do that. And what we do is we give them attributes and data that they can use for these models. This is not to say that we don't do these things. We do these things especially to prove that the things that we build are actually useful, right? So we study, we call them impact studies. We study what is the impact of what we have developed in terms of for example, estimating risk. And to do that analysis, yes, we do this type of modeling. We have a database of claims and other things that we can use to prove that we have that our attributes have an effect and are predictive of certain type of things.
Yeah, that sounds very interesting. So building on that, let's dig a little deeper. So we started off at the very top of the stack, which is, you know, what does your company do? We've talked a little bit about the specific machine learning projects and the techniques or algorithms that you're using. Let's dig a bit deeper into your tool stack. So again, you two are in companies that are, you're doing work that seems to be a little off the beaten path, pardon the pun, a little bit off the map of what a lot of companies are doing with data science. And you're doing lots of geospatial analysis, all sorts of calculations, and that sort of thing. So the question is, what sort of tools are you using for this? So I know, Giacomo, you mentioned a little bit about neural networks and a little bit about classical machine learning. But let's dig deeper into that. Easy question for you. TensorFlow or Torch, or neither?
Both. That's the answer. So these days we are mostly Torch, PyTorch, but TensorFlow is having a comeback. So we are very carefully not committing too much to a specific technology, right? We want to be able to use whatever makes sense for a specific problem. So these days we have both. Even though Torch is the majority of what we do, but it's not the only one. And we can switch at any time.
Excellent. And follow-up question then, are you going straight to the TensorFlow APIs, or are you talking to it through Keras?
For TensorFlow, it's mostly Keras, but we do have some more custom things that they use the lower level API.
All right. Sounds great. And a couple of quick ones for you, Linda. So would it be safe to assume that your team is using mostly Python, or are you a combined Python and R shop?
I think it's really like a combination. You know, it really depends on which one works better, right? For example, R is mostly better at lots of like statistical related. But nowadays, Python is very powerful in terms of processing the data. So, you know, we are using Databricks as a main interface to craft the analysis, data analytics, and data science products. So it's really a combination of like Scala, SQL, Python, R, you know, whatever works better to serve the business.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. And building on that, then let's talk more about some of the technologies you're using behind the scenes. So you're both doing some amount of geospatial analysis. It sounds like, Giacomo, your company might be doing a little bit more. That seems to be your bread and butter. But Linda, let's talk for a second about what sort of tools your company is using for geospatial. Are you just using mostly PostGIS? Are you using other tools? What's your story?
I think it's a little bit hard to summarize just, you know, in one or two different tools, because, you know, at HireCard, our like analytics or data science function was, you know, this is relatively young company, and we are recently centralized, you know, this. So we start by laying out the foundation by like a build a data ecosystem and then like find different tools for analysis and building the models. And specifically for the like a geospatial data, as you know, HireCard is a front runner of mobility as a service. So our data consists of owners and gig drivers. So by the geospatial data really help us to understand the market demand and supply, and therefore lots of our like analysis or model is around that area. So we can better inform the owners and fleet operators on the business strategy. And doing so, you know, may review underserved or overserved areas, adding in data about what people are frequently search online for the information about the rental cars would make the results even more accurate. In addition to geospatial data, we also have the vehicle telematics data. When used in combination, we can capture the driver risk, like driver behaviors in real time, and alert drivers and owners when certain situations, you know, happen caused by risky driver behavior. Like I think Jimoko mentioned that regarding like the risk predictions, and we are doing that too, because it helps us to make sure, you know, our drivers, you know, are behaving well as, you know, it helps the owners to grow. It helps, you know, also helps improve claims management and reduce costs.
Yeah, that's, I didn't think that you'd be doing all those risk calculations, but now that you've explained it, it makes perfect sense, because you're talking about, you know, essentially providing one person's car to another person to drive. I think being able to keep track of the drivers and their safety and all of that would be very important.
Right. Yeah. I think all behind the scenes is we have a very great data ecosystem, from data generation via business systems, back end and front end, and to intermediary data where I think the data is stored and streamed, to commodity data where data is curated step by step and prepped for analysis use, and eventually may flow into other systems, you know, to inform business decision making.
That's great. I have one question about the telematics, but I'll come back to that in just a minute. Giacomo, quick question for you. So you mentioned that you're dealing with just tons and tons of data. Like you said, the field of geospatial analysis, it just keeps growing. What does that mean as far as your company's storage technology? In other words, have you been able to use lots of off-the-shelf databases, or have you had to build custom things to support that?
So for the data storage, we are using existing solutions.
Good.
It's, you know, we are a you know, medium-sized startup, so we don't really have the time to develop really custom things if we can use existing solutions, and the existing solutions are very good at the moment. But there is a lot of complexity though from the stemming from the fact that you need to bring all these technologies together, and it's also not only about one specific piece, but it's about the workflow, right? So you want to have an entire workflow that goes from you know, data ingestion and transformation and all of that, so the data engineering part, all the way to, you know, analytics and model training and data science, to deployment, in one, you know, unique workflow that is, you know, with the least friction, as least friction as you can, and it's, you know, coherent and performant, and all of that. And so there is really a lot of effort and a lot of investment going into bringing this workflow and improving this workflow all the time. And we use a lot of existing solutions, but we also develop a lot of glue pieces that bring this whole thing into a unique workflow with good interfaces and a good process overall.
Mm-hmm. No, that makes a lot of sense. I know for a lot of companies, when you have tech talent in-house, it's very tempting to just want to build everything, right? You look at an existing solution and it doesn't exactly match what you're trying to do, and you figure, well, we can write code, we can build our own. And no, that gets very costly, always, very painful.
There's always a very, very dangerous and hidden cost there, which is building something is 10%, I think. You can build something, sure, we have the talent to build whatever we need to build. But then you have to maintain it. You have to make it work, not just for now, but for the next 5 years. You have to link it with everything else that you have. And so there's always this hidden cost that is really, I think, it's really dangerous because you are overcommitting yourself without realizing it. So it's always something to keep in mind.
I wholeheartedly agree. There's an old and perhaps just apocryphal statistic in the software development biz, which is that, you know, 80% of the total cost of ownership of a custom software effort is in the maintenance side of things, right? And so the tools we have these days, they make it very easy to build something quickly and get it going, but then you have to take care of it. And that's where it gets painful. So, Linda, I see that you're smiling. It sounds like your team has had some experience.
Yeah, the maintenance part, is definitely a lot. And it can be definitely like time consuming and the resource consuming.
Okay, so that let's head down a quick side road on that for a second. So both of you have tons of technology talent inside your companies, which means you could go off and build these things if you wanted to. How do you enforce that discipline in your teams to convince people that, hey, let's stay on the path of what our company is meant to do as opposed to building all these side tools? So Linda, let's start with you on that. Like, how do you make those decisions in your company, and how do you bring about that discipline?
Yeah, I think it's definitely a challenging question that we are facing, you know, every day. Yeah. I think in order to resolve it, I think I'm always in the mindset of, you know, how data analytics or data science can add value to a business are first support better decision making, and secondly, bring added value to the customers. After all, we are supporting a business that is developing, you know, like every day with lots of dynamics. So that is why that is basically a guideline, like a North Star, that's for us to make any of the decisions. When we launch a project, when we start working on a task, when we start to solving like a technology tickets, we have to always evaluate how that aligns with the overall company strategy, the company roadmap, and our roadmap. So given that, you know, we set the priorities, it definitely, you know, answers a lot of questions, because not all business can afford, you know, waiting for months just to develop like a maybe pretty cool in-house tool. And another things I think is very important is the methodology we use is iteration and showing empathy to the business stakeholders. Because, you know, we are working like with data, like data science or data analytics. Our customers are business stakeholders. So we want to think in their shoes of how we can better help them in order to drive the business with our knowledge and the skill set we have. It's like, I think the analogy can be like how we build a car, right? There are two ways we can build a car. The first way is we start to first building the wheels and then building like the, you know, the metal, the shells, you know, eventually bring different parts together. Then, you know, in 2 years we build a car. And another way is we first build maybe a scooter, maybe a skateboard, then build a scooter. So someone at least can ride on it and then can travel from one place to another, and then maybe build a motorcycle, then maybe build some like a very mini car, then building a car. So in that case, the business have something to use, and then they can, you know, we can keep iterate on it rather than entirely fully dedicate to build this in-house tool, which, you know, basically pose a gap for how we can help with a business.
Yeah, I like that. And I think empathy is definitely key in this field for the reasons you've mentioned and beyond. And let's flip over to Giacomo then. So Would you say that your team follows Lynda's approach, which is a lot of empathy for the end user is what keeps you on task, or is there something else that your folks are doing?
Yeah, there is definitely that. There's also the, you know, I think being a startup, right, it kind of forces you to be focused, right? Because exactly, you cannot wait 2 years to build a car, right? There's just no way you can do that. You have to have something to give to your customers way before that. And so that's definitely a pressure in the right direction, right? To be able to deliver something valuable in the time that is the right timing for the growth of the company. There are two kind of images. One is going in the direction that that we were talking about the car, right? In many ways, right, while you are building, while you are fixing the motorcycle, right, you're building in the garage, you're building the car, right? So kind of be ready for the next step, right? So there is this kind of you want to be delivering value to the customers as soon as possible, but you also want to invest time into preparing for the future. And you want to have this balance that allow you to scale, to keep scaling, to keep improving. And so it's a delicate balance. And it's also, I think, depending on the teams, right? We have the, in our company, we have the machine learning team, the platform team, we have different teams, right? And some of these technologies are more mature than others. And so I also think that, you know, the approach that you take might not be the same for your software component and your machine learning component. Because in machine learning, I think you have to anticipate that there is a lot of risk in terms of things that can change, right? So you don't want to be too committed to something. You were talking about PyTorch and TensorFlow, right? That's an example. There are things that are maybe even more important than the framework, right? For example, you might not want to commit specifically to a technology in deep learning. For example, convolutional neural networks have been around for several years now, right? And they are a mature technology that people can use, right? And they work very well. But now there are transformers coming, right? In the last year and a half, 2 years, there's been this constant improvement of the transformers in this space, right? And so, for example, there, you have to see this coming, right? And you have to be ready to say, okay, when the time comes, I might need to change the technology, right? And so you have to anticipate these things so that, you know, on one side you are going with the motorbike that you have, and on the other hand, you are already working on the car, right? And here maybe we go outside of the metaphor. Sometimes you can use, you know, the pieces that you already developed for the future, you can start using today, right? And so you bring them in the current workflow as soon as they're ready, also to get some mileage on them. In many ways, another image that I often use is that we are building the airplane while we're flying. So you want to change pieces, right, at the right time so you don't fall, but you get a better and better airplane. And so, I think it's a game of balance. And again, depending on the team, the balance can be in a different place. For example, for software, things are more stable, technologies are more understood. So there you might commit more to a specific technology or something specific that you can do in data engineering or machine learning and data science.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's definitely a balance, like regarding certain, like, for example, in my team, we implement like an 80-20 rule, as people, you know, to have the sort of like the independent work or brainstorming sessions, you know, to work on something. Probably takes a little bit more time, but lots of them actually turns into some interesting projects that we can do. Yeah, because lots of work in this field for data analysis or data science are, after all, very open-ended. There could be lots of different ways to do things, and there's always probably a better way for that.
Yeah, if I can add one thing there is that I think there's also another aspect that should be considered, I think, which is it is true that you want to deliver fast, right? But this shouldn't be an excuse to do sloppy things, right? So to work, to introduce technical debt where you don't need to introduce technical debt, right? So I think there is a little bit of tension between moving fast and doing the right things. But you want to do, you know, you want to try to avoid introducing technical debt as much as you can. So sometimes slowing down just a little bit now to be able to avoid being slowed down a lot in the future is the right thing to do. Right? So you don't want to cut too many corners because you will have to pay for that at some point. That's why I think this notion of technical debt is very interesting, because it's a debt that you're going to pay. And so you want to be careful where you put it, right? Sometimes and in some places is the right move, but it should be considered. It's not free, right?
Yeah, definitely. I think the analogy I like to use when it comes to debt is you're spot on. And the analogy I like to use when it comes to debt is it's like debt in the real world. Sometimes you can have a very strong return on capital, right? If you're borrowing money to buy a company that you flip, let's say looking at private equity, that's a good return on the capital. That's great. On the other hand, if you're a small business and you've taken out tons and tons of loans, that might help you out. But at that point, you're so leveraged that you're not ready for any change that comes your way. And so something small that comes along can really push you over the edge. And so that's when debt can really own you instead of the other way around. Also, it's funny because both of you have talked about, you know, this notion of balance. And Giacomo, you mentioned this notion of picking the right time to swap out parts and make these changes. And also, Linda, you mentioned the open-endedness of data science projects. And that actually dovetails very well with my next question for you both. So we'll take a second to set this up here, right? One harsh reality of ML work is that everything is an experiment. And like you said, Linda, that's open-ended, and also results are deterministic. So it's entirely possible to launch an R&D effort and do all of the quote-unquote right things, like, you know, claim the data, trial the techniques, all that. And you can still end up without a working model. And since there's no hard end date on a research effort, it's possible to keep investing time and effort on something that doesn't really pan out. And so you have to develop an approach to running your projects in a way that will maximize your opportunity, but also limit your downside loss in terms of burning time, right? So, you know, for example, some of the audience have heard me talk about this idea of shaping AI research into a series of sprints so that you periodically pause and look around, review your results, and see whether it's worth it to continue, right? So given that, I suspect you two both have a ton of experience in figuring out how to approach R&D projects in your company so that you can maximize your return, but also limit your risk of downside loss in terms of time and effort, right? So, Linda, I see you shaking your head there. So let's start with you. How do you handle R&D projects in your company?
It's definitely another good topic to discuss, because it's definitely there's no absolute answer, you know, like a 1, 2, 3, you know, for the steps. What I feel first is it never hurts to stress the importance of management commitment from top down, because a good program would be a non-starter without securing that commitment, especially for the R&D projects. At the same time, I think planning is also key. How we can align with the business strategy and the overall roadmap. Like, you know, we just talked about, I think, you know, the North Star for the analytics is a better decision making for the business and added value to the customers. Therefore, everything we do needs to be aligned with the business strategy and overall roadmap, because otherwise our new projects can be too open-ended without a defined scope. Then I think, for example, for my team, I start by organizing a recurring cross-functional knowledge share meeting and a recurring idea brainstorm meeting, where all team members as well as the stakeholders and participants are encouraged to share, learn, and think outside the box to leverage their own knowledge and expertise to create new ideas. For example, we used to have someone with a sales background and experience in the business share some like key facts on user friction points, which can be was very valuable, and we are able to turn it into some like concrete projects. Also, because we talk about the R&D projects is sometimes can be a little bit open-ended, a regular status update is also very helpful. It is important to keep everyone on the same page. Then last but not least, is realizing that not all R&D projects can finish with good results. When we train the model, right, we know sometimes no matter what we do, we cannot have a prediction with high accuracy. In that case, don't get discouraged. Rely on trial and error. If researchers are afraid of making mistakes, they will be far less willing to try their more outlandish ideas that might just be the key to success. Acknowledging mistakes is definitely part of the process. The most important thing is to take to heart the lessons learned.
I like the sound of that. And so Giacomo, what's your take on diving into the outlandish projects? How do you frame that for your team?
Yeah, so I think, it's a very interesting problem to have, I think. And it's one of the things that I love about this field, right? It's not just about you have a recipe and you apply it over and over again. It doesn't work like that. Something that works for this project might not work for the next. And so you have to be, I think that's where the science in the name comes from, right? You have to be open to what you have in front of you and be able to change your preconceptions about a problem, about how to solve a problem, how to approach a problem. And that being said, there are things that are best practices that I really believe in. One, for example, is to try to start from a simple baseline, right? Something simple that you can realize relatively quickly with relatively low investment to prove to yourself that there is something there, and at least to prove to yourself that, you know, you can build something that goes in the direction where you want to go. Maybe the performances are nowhere near what you need, but at least you have a stick in the ground, right? And that's something that you can also measure your progress against, right? So definitely start simple and from a baseline that you can build relatively quickly. And then here there are a lot of things. You want to be very disciplined in your experiments, right? So you need to track what you do, try to understand, okay, I got this improvement. What caused this improvement? So you want to, for example, change one thing at a time and not 20 things at a time. You want to be aware of everything that there is to know about that particular problem, which means spending time in researching, like papers, blog posts, other companies working in the same field, talks on YouTube, whatever you have, right, to try to understand the state of the art of that particular problem or technique or whatever you're working on. And then, you know, try to work your way iteratively towards a good solution. Sometimes you also have to be ready to bail out, like as you said at the beginning, right? So sometimes it's just not going to work, or more often it's not going to work in the timeline that you need, right? Because that's another reality of it, right? Back when I was in college, right, I could spend a lot of time on a project and just, you know, wait for it to pan out while maybe I was doing other things, right? Sometimes in a production setting, that's not something that you can do, right? At some point you have to decide, okay, maybe it's not the time for this. Maybe we can reevaluate it next year, right? And maybe in that time, something else comes along, a new research result or a new technique or a new technology or that makes that problem easier to solve, right? And then the last thing that I want to say is that you want to have a balance again between having short-term R&D projects and long-term R&D projects. So Long term can be more outlandish, to use a word I've used before, and maybe, you know, they can maybe be high risk, high return kind of thing, right? So it's something that you're not sure is going to pan out, but if it does, it's going to be a big deal, right? And so it's still worth investing in that, I think. But at the same time, you want to have shorter term things that you can deliver on. And this is going to help you in many different ways. It's going to help you with your stakeholders that are not going to get mad at you because you are spending a lot of time and you don't have results. You're going to bring value, right? But you also are going to learn things along the way that might help you actually in the other things that are harder, right? So kind of trying to approach things in this kind of way, I think it's helpful, and it kind of it keeps the science part in the name, right? You want to approach it scientifically, right?
Yeah, I can definitely appreciate everything you're saying there. And one thing you said there, Giacomo, that really resonated with me is when you talked about, you know, effectively finding balance between, you know, to borrow Linda's term again, some of the more outlandish projects, and also some of the ones that are a little more stable and a little more likely to pan out, you know, and some other circles in which I hang out, we like to call that taking the portfolio management approach to data science projects. You know, sort of like when you're building a portfolio on Wall Street, you can't have the whole thing be a high risk investment. You can't have the whole thing be super stable. You need a mix. Now, the thing is, if you've had a really, really good year on returns, maybe you can take on a bit more risk, try something a bit dicier that might have a larger return. If you've had a rough year, you know, if you've had just project after project that just hasn't really panned out, maybe you want to dial it back a bit. Maybe put the outlandish stuff on the back burner for a while and build up some more of that trust again with your stakeholders to show that, yes, machine learning does have value here. It can provide return. We just didn't have a good year last year. So I can definitely appreciate that.
Yeah, I like that image a lot.
And also zooming out. Oh, thanks. Take it. Run with it. It's all yours. But, you know, something I liked about both of your answers is that I heard a lot of really solid terminology in there, you know, balance, discipline, research, structure, and taking a scientific approach. I think those were all very useful. I think it's also sometimes a little tougher to get those points across to both the business stakeholders as well as some of the younger data scientists. In some cases, both of those groups are just very, very eager to get moving on something, or they're very eager to dive in. And sometimes it takes a little extra discipline on our part to pull them back and say, well, hang on, let's think this through, let's structure this, let's position ourselves for a win, right? Yeah, cool. Yeah, given that, I do want to be respectful of your time. Oh, go ahead, sorry.
No, sorry, maybe if I can jump in on that. I think...
Please do.
That is very true. And I think, you know, personally, one of the things that we do here at CAPE that I think are very successful and very useful is this idea of hackathons. We have twice a year, we have hackathons where we have a few days where everybody can spend their time on whatever they want, however they want it, for the most part. I mean, within reason, but but that's the idea, right? So to foster things that come from the base, the people that are the closest to the problems, right? And this is very helpful in many different ways. First, some of the problems that we have came out of that. So sometimes the ideas that come out of there are actually very successful and can be made into a product relatively easily. But also it serves other things. It keeps people engaged. And it gives them the opportunity to propose something, right? And to try to make a pitch about something that according to them is worth looking into. And also it's a very good opportunity to learn things and to try things that are maybe a little bit outside of what you would deal with on a daily basis. And so I think it kind of gives the opportunity to just bring out something that is also, I mean, this energy that you were talking about, which is definitely a positive energy, right? It's the energy of somebody who wants to go and make a difference, right? You don't want to you don't want to turn that down, right? You want to you know, channel it in the right direction, but you want to keep that energy. And so things like, you know, hackathons and in general are keeping this an open mind about ideas, about things can help you with that.
Yeah, I really like the sound of that. So just a quick one before we wrap up, another quick side journey for us here. Linda, is your company HireCar running similar internal hackathons or other ways to give people space to try new ideas?
Yeah, I think we have hackathon as well. It's definitely, you know, create like an environment, encourage, you know, the promote the cross-functional work, right? And also, like I just mentioned, for my team, actually for lots of team, we have, you know, like the cross-functional, like knowledge share meeting and brainstorm meetings. So that really provides like a channel for people to think outside the box and how we can leverage, you know, different expertise and tackle the problem at the same time. And then, like, in fact, because to my understanding, you know, we work for like data analytics or data science. It's really like a cross-functional area between business, statistics, and like developing. So that's really, and we are serving the business stakeholders from all different departments of the business. So both, you know, if, you know, for me to like real understand the problem and to have lots of like deep conversations with each functions of the business. And for my teammates to start, I usually encourage everyone, you know, to start from, you know, listening to sales calls, listening to the support call, you know, logging into the business systems to get the backend story, because we are working with data and we need to make sure the data makes sense. When we produce something, we need to tell the story behind the data to people. If we don't lose that context, we don't know, oh, we are helping sales department to solve a problem X. We don't know, you know, other context, but just very dry numbers. It's not really, you know, the full values of data analytics. That also routes back to something I think I just mentioned regarding the empathy. We come from like a scientific approach, and we need to have a combination or balance with the business strategies. Not everything lines up well, you know, 100%, but we need to find a middle ground so that we can collaborate and work together to drive the business growth.
Yeah, you will get no argument from me on that one. And in fact, I'm so glad to hear you say that, because I thought I was the only person who encouraged data scientists and developers to participate on sales calls. That is a great way, like you said, to learn what your company is really doing, understand who your company is serving and how as a data scientist you can make all that work even better. So we're coming up on our end time here, and I do want to be mindful of your schedule as well. Linda, Giacomo, you've both been very generous today, giving me the time to tell your stories and tell me more about the work you're doing and the project your company is running, and also some of the techniques and tactics you use to approach your business challenges. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. I've been your host, Q McCallum, Senior Content Advisor at Formulated By. As always, I'd like to thank the Formulated By production team for taking care of the audio and all of the other heavy lifting that makes this podcast possible. Feel free to check out past episodes on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and anywhere else you find your listening material. You can also find Data Science Salon on Twitter and LinkedIn. Now, just a reminder, Formulated By is the company behind the Data Science Salon conferences. These are multi-day events where leading data scientists share their experience, expertise, and best practices on how to apply AI and machine learning to different industries. So if you're interested in attending, you can check out the Data Science Salon website, that's datascience.salon, for the full schedule and registration. I hope to see you there.